From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In a story shaping up with the twists of Shakespearean drama, a federal judge today sent Judith Miller of the New York Times to jail for again refusing to reveal a confidential source in the outing of CIA operative Valerie Plame. Time Magazine's Matthew Cooper avoided going to jail by agreeing to cooperate with the grand jury after, he said, his source today released him from a confidentiality agreement. Time Magazine had already handed over Cooper's notes and emails against his will. Syndicated columnist Robert Novak first disclosed Valerie Plame's name 2 years ago after Plame's husband, former U.S. Ambassador Joseph Wilson, wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times critical of President Bush's justifications for war with Iraq. Bill Keller, the New York Times executive editor, spoke after today's ruling.
I think that anybody who believes that the government and other powerful institutions should be closely and aggressively watched should feel a chill up their spine today.
Time Magazine's Matthew Cooper also answered a few questions.
This is a sad day for not only for journalists, for our country. It is a sad time when two journalists who are simply doing their jobs and trying to keep confidences and report important stories face the prospect of going to prison for keeping those confidences.
The case is a complicated one that has gone to the top echelon of American government. President Bush and Vice President Cheney have been interviewed by investigators. Karl Rove's name has come up as the possible source for the leak. But tonight, a journalist sits in jail for protecting a source. This hour on Point, a reporter in jail, a mystery still unsolved, and allegations of a blow to the workings of the American press. You can join the conversation. Is jailing Judy Miller right or wrong? And who will tell the nation's darkest secrets if journalists cannot guarantee confidentiality to anonymous sources? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We begin tonight in Washington, where Tom Brune has been covering the story for Newsday and was in the courtroom today. Tom, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me on.
Please give us a feeling for the courtroom today. What was Judith Miller's attitude? What was the atmosphere in that courtroom? It must have been tense.
Well, the courthouse was packed with journalists and observers who wanted to see this momentous occasion. This truly is the biggest clash between the government and the news media in three decades. Not since the Pentagon Papers has there been such a stir about this relationship. It was pretty tense, and everybody was pretty drawn. I mean, the looks on the faces of Cooper and Miller as they entered the courtroom certainly showed a lot of anxiety about what was to come.
And Judith Miller herself, she was the one at the end of the day facing going to jail. What was her attitude? Did she speak? What was her body language?
She stood up and read a statement in the courtroom that she had crafted beforehand. And in it, she was very forthright about her respect for the law, her own experiences in seeing when there was a breakdown in the law and the chaos that ensued. But she was very, very clear. She told the judge in no uncertain terms that she could not break her confidence. She could not break her promise to her sources that she would not reveal their names.
And she was saying she could not do that even though, in this case, if they told her that Valerie Plame was an undercover CIA agent, they were very likely committing a felony.
That's correct. It's an absolutist position. She believes that once you make that promise, you cannot go back on it. And frankly, she pointed out, when you make that promise, you often do not know what you're going to hear. And that was part of her position.
Tom Brune, stand by. Judith Miller was publicly not on tape today. She's in jail tonight. But we spoke with her last October about this very case. She was with us on Point. I want to play just a little bit of her explanation of why she was prepared to stand by this confidentiality, even though there may be a crime involved. Here's Judith Miller from October 15th, last fall.
I don't give these people political correctness tests or virtue tests. I take information from everyone who feels that he or she has a grievance or a story to tell. And then I try and factor in the person's motives and why they're coming to me and whether or not the public needs to know that. I'm speaking hypothetically here, not about this case. This is, you know, just how I go about doing my job. And I think that when one starts saying certain individuals deserve protection and confidentiality and others don't, simply because you don't like their political perspective or you may not like what they have to say, that really means that a whole point of view that might not be heard will not be heard if the reporter makes that kind of decision. So each reporter must draw the line for himself or herself. But I think in my case, I want to hear what anybody has to say. That's called reporting. And then, you know, go on from that point.
That's the voice of Judith Miller talking with us here at On Point on October 15th, 2004. Just last fall, she was there in court today. Tonight, she's in jail. Matthew Cooper is not, Tom. How did that unfold?
That's a very interesting development. It surprised everybody. He even said it was a stunning development to himself. Must understand, last week, Time magazine and Matt Cooper parted ways in their stand on this particular issue. Matt Cooper stood fast. He said, I'm going to keep my promise to my source. Time magazine said, we are not above the law. And they turned over materials they had from Matt Cooper that were on the company's system.
Right.
We're talking emails, notes, mm-hmm. whatever. This morning, Matt Cooper said, after his son had gone off to camp, he'd already told his son, I may not see you for a long time after this. His source called up and said, I'm going to give you a release here. The way that Cooper put it was that it was specific, it was personal, and it was unambiguous, a waiver that said you do not have to protect my confidentiality anymore.
And that means that Matthew Cooper has now agreed to testify before the grand jury.
That is correct. He said he will go and talk to the grand jury.
Tom, bring us up to date on what's known about where the grand jury investigation stands at this point.
That is one of the mysteries of this case. As a matter of fact, the New York Times pointed this out several times, is that this is a confounding case. We do not know what the special prosecutor, Patrick Fitzgerald, who's the U.S. attorney for Chicago, has going on right now. Ostensibly, it's an investigation into whether the federal law against revealing the identity of undercover agents, mm-hmm. but it could be also obstruction of justice, it could be perjury, it could be a number of different things. I talked to Zachary Taylor, who used to be a U.S. attorney in Brooklyn, and he said this could be a case where he has some administration official or some target saying one thing, and he needs enough reporters to refute that so that he can go forward with his case.
So investigators have talked with Bush, with Cheney, with Cheney's chief of staff, Libby Lewis, with former White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez. Just in the last week, we've heard Karl Rove's name come out here. What's bringing that name into play?
What is bringing that name into play is after Time magazine produced its documents from Cooper, there were reports by MSNBC and others that the source identified was Karl Rove. Karl Rove's attorney over the 4th of July weekend said that, yes, his client had indeed talked with Cooper at some point during that time, but that he had not revealed Plame's name, that he had not broken any laws, and that the prosecutor had assured him that he was not a target of the probe.
Or, as I recall exactly what the lawyer said, that Karl Rove had not knowingly broken any law. Is there a difference there?
Is there an
important distinction?
And you've hit on the head why this law is so hard to use to prosecute people. It has to be a knowing violation, a knowing effort that you are revealing the identity of a covert operative and putting them in danger.
But of course, the conspiracy theorists here, and they may not be wrong at all, are saying this was very knowing. This was an effort to punish former Ambassador Joseph Wilson for him coming out and writing in the New York Times, as it happens, that the Bush administration was making up reasons to go to war with Iraq, that this was a deliberate effort to hit back at a man who had put a dent in the president's case for war.
Absolutely, that is what Ambassador Wilson has said time and time again. There have been others who said that it does appear to be some kind of a smear. There's no question that administration officials were shopping around this idea that maybe Wilson was not such a stellar person. And as a matter of fact, I happened to find a subpoena, the only subpoena that's been revealed in this case, in which the special prosecutor was specifically looking for the actions of the administration between the time of Wilson's op-ed in which he undermined the president's case, and Novak's column 7 days later.
And what about Robert Novak in all this? Do we know if he's testified? Why isn't he in jail tonight?
That is a very good question. He has said that he will not divulge anything until after this case is settled, and then he's supposed to write a column that'll tell us all. He refuses to say whether he's talked to Fitzgerald. He refuses to identify what he called in his column two senior administration officials. Why he must have cooperated to some degree with the prosecutor, I can only imagine, unless he's a target of something, and that's unclear as well.
Tom, where is Judith Miller tonight, and how long is she likely to be locked up?
Judith Miller was taken to a suburban Washington jail facility. She really strenuously argued against being put in the D.C. Jail because it's overcrowded, and she said it would be dangerous for her.
Mm-hmm.
I've gotten it confirmed that she's in Alexandria, Virginia, the detention center there. They have a women's unit, and she may spend the next 4 months there.
Until the grand jury wraps up its work on her contempt of court charges.
Absolutely, unless she decides to talk. Or there's another possibility that Floyd Abrams, one of her attorneys, raised. After a couple of several weeks, they may go back into court and say, look, the law says if a reporter is not going to talk, they're just absolutely refuse to reveal their source, then you've got to set them free because it moves from coercion to punishment.
Mm.
And the law says you can't punish.
But tonight, Judith Miller sits in jail. Tom Bruhn with Newsday, thank you so much for opening up the story for us.
Thank you.
We're talking tonight about the jailing of New York Times reporter Judith Miller for protecting a confidential source in the outing of CIA operative Valerie Plame. What do you think? Is this jailing right or wrong? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the jailing of New York Times reporter Judith Miller today for protecting a confidential source in the outing of CIA operative Valerie Plame. We're looking at the facts of the case and its implications for American journalism. You can join us tonight. Who's going to talk to reporters about the country's most sensitive issues, about the dark stuff, about wrongdoing, if they can't trust their identities will be protected? And does it make a difference that Judith Miller's source may him or herself have broken the law by talking? And why is a journalist the one in jail when somebody else committed a felony? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Today, executive editor of the New York Times, Bill Keller, lamented Judith Miller being in jail.
This is a chilling conclusion to an utterly confounding case. It's confounding because of the mystery about exactly what crime has been committed and what exactly the special prosecutor hopes to accomplish by the draconian act of punishing an honorable journalist. It's chilling because it's likely to serve future cover-ups of information that happens in the recesses of government and other powerful institutions.
New York Times executive editor Bill Keller today. We are joined tonight from New York City by Jay Rosen. He's associate professor of journalism at New York University, author of What Are Journalists For? Jay Rosen, thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Also, I should say, author of Press Think, a weblog about journalism and its ordeals, which he introduced in September 2003. We're also joined tonight from Philadelphia by Ann Gordon. She is managing editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer. Ann, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And let me go to you first, if I may. You're not directly involved in this, but you're managing editor of a big newspaper looking on at what's happening. What do you see here? Do you see a journalist defying the law, putting herself above the law, or do you see American journalism under attack? Do you feel that chilling effect that Bill Keller's talking about?
Well, let me answer that a little bit in parts. Yes, I absolutely do see a chilling effect. I think that this will undermine news gathering throughout the country, and perhaps particularly in the middle of the country, in the Midwest and in other areas.
Why there in particular?
Well, I think that there is the unglamorous stories that will go unreported and to get this kind of attention, for instance. It's the city council that the secret meetings, the small political actions that have big consequences in small towns but that don't make big news that may be undermined the most by this.
And you think reporters and editors will simply look at this and say, my gosh, or city council people, I guess, in that case, will say, I can't talk because my anonymity won't be protected. Do they see a precedent here?
I think they will have serious questions, and rightly so, to ask of news media organizations, and they will be rightly concerned about whether their anonymity, their confidentiality will in fact be held.
What about at your own newspaper? You've got a long history, a proud history, a lot of prizes on the wall, many of them no doubt built with people telling you things off the record. Can you imagine your own work there being chilled by this?
Oh, I absolutely can. I believe that there will be a lot of litigators that begin to ask a lot of questions and begin to press and offer subpoenas as a way of perhaps diverting the investigation from what the true point of the investigation originally was to muddy the waters. I think there'll be a lot of reasons. Politics and law is dirty business, and this will, I believe, bring out some of the worst in some cases. But you had also asked earlier about whether I believe this was above the law, and I want to say that I happen to agree with something that Matt Cooper said early on. He's a reporter from Time Magazine, when he noted that it was a honor in civil disobedience, which is what Judith Miller is really practicing at this point, and there's also honor in what Time Magazine decided to do, which was to talk more openly about its sources, and then at the last minute, Matt Cooper's source relieving him of the burden of confidentiality under these circumstances.
So you're giving honor to both sides, but they took pretty different paths. Jay Rosen, how are you looking at what's going on here? Is this a real challenge to the freedom and functioning of the American press, or is this a special case, a one-off?
I see this as a case where almost everyone pushed things too far, resulting in a truly tragic but also incredibly moving and dramatic day today. I think it's a tragedy that Judith Miller is going to jail. I was almost brokenhearted at the thought of Matt Cooper and his kids being separated by this, and I think there's something incredibly powerful about Miller's sacrifice, but we also have to ask whether good judgment was shown here. And what I see when I look at this case is just a lack of moderate judgment almost from the very beginning, with the person who leaked to Novak printing the name of a CIA agent, to the prosecutor going after people who weren't even involved in that column, to the attacks by the prosecutor on the integrity of the journalist, and to a degree in Judith Miller's stance herself. If I were a friend of hers, I think some kind of prudential judgment was called for, some way to back off and reach some sort of conclusion without the final denouement. But once she decided to go to the mat with her source, this day was inevitable unless the Supreme Court intervened, and it decided not to.
But where are you saying that Judith Miller went wrong in your view, or that her judgment, there was a lapse? I mean, she didn't publish the story. She went out and asked questions about something that, I presume, or else she was contacted, but about something that was clearly afoot in Washington. Isn't that her job? Where's the misstep here?
Well, the right to confidential sources is not guaranteed in the Constitution, even though people derive a constitutional claim. We don't have that as part of our settled law right now. And it simply isn't the case that that right to protect a source trumps all other things in the current state of the law.
But you know, journalists use that every day, and they use it most importantly in the most difficult stories.
Yes, but I think what the case is saying is not that confidential sources are no longer safe. What the case today is telling people is that if you are involved in leaking and a crime may be committed, your name is not going to be protected. And that's different than saying anybody who's ever been a confidential source is now at risk. So that's what the court said, is that if you are involved in a crime and you're linking, then your name may eventually come out. That's what we learned today from the events we heard in court.
And Gordon, maybe that makes this a special case, not from Judith Miller or Matt Cooper's side, but on the part of the leaker. It's saying to leakers something narrower than you were suggesting. Jay Rosen saying that if you want confidentiality, don't expect it if you're committing a crime with what you say.
Exactly.
Well,
Anne, what do you think?
There's something else here. I think the fact of the matter is this case has been bizarre from the start. This is an unfortunate you know, conflict between the rights of the press and the government, but the reality of it is that it is still very unclear whether laws were broken, because deliberately disclosing the operative's name, you know, is definitely illegal, but only if the government is actively trying to, you know, conceal this relationship. We still don't know whether, in fact, it was a government person who, in fact, leaked this. So I think you have a lot of questions to ask about whether, in fact, this is as straightforward as it is now being portrayed. We still have lots of questions about where this investigation is going and where it will ultimately end and to what end. People, Judith Miller reported on something and didn't publish a story. Cooper reported on the aftermath of this. That we are 2 and 3 steps away from what the point of the investigation was.
And meanwhile, nobody from that end of things sitting in jail tonight. A lot of callers want to join us. I want to begin to turn to them. Rose is calling from Pinehurst, North Carolina. Rose, what do you think?
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was thinking back to the quote that Time Magazine stated was that they were not above the law.
Right.
And I feel that no journalist is above the law. I also feel that there should have been some prior investigation and some more diligence on the part of the court before placing her into confinement. But if it's a matter of national security, my opinion is that sources should be presented.
But national security, I mean, what? Yes, Valerie Plame's already been outed here, and you could say that in exposing an undercover CIA operative, that's a matter of national security in some degree. But isn't what's really being protected here somebody? I mean, Judith Miller's being punished in a way for doing her reporting. And so the leaker's name is not out there.
Right. She's being punished for doing for using the implication that her confidentiality and her sources should be sacred. And I agree to some extent. But this CIA agent now has been identified, and our national security is in jeopardy because of that. We're not going to let agents go out in covert operations with the fear that they're going to be exposed.
But if, let me just ask you, Rose, if reporters can't say to people, I will protect you if you give me the down and dirty here, if you tell me what's really going on, how are we going to learn what's really going on?
Well, I think that you should be protected to an extent. If there's a matter of security or a breach of security somewhere along the line, then that's the court's position, is to get that source.
Rose, we've got it. Thanks very much for your call. Jay, is Rose singing your song here?
Well, I think that the courts have actually been pretty good at protecting whistleblowers, but we have to go back even further than this case to why people leak stuff in the first place. We talk about it, Tom, as an issue in journalism, and it is. But from the leaker's point of view, what is going on is a form of politics. That's what leaking is. It's the origins of leaking are in when one side in a dispute in the government loses within the government, they appeal to public opinion, and leaking is sort of as old as democracy in that sense.
Politics by other means.
It's politics by other means, that's right. And so it's always going to go out. Now, if the message to leakers is, you will be protected unless you commit a crime, it's hard for me to see that that's a First Amendment loss. Remember, what was the act here? Mm. The basic act here was somebody in the White House saying to Wilson, you come out like that against the president, your wife's career is going to be shot at the CIA. Mm. And that's exactly what happened. And her career as an operative is shot at the CIA. That was the act. And Robert Novak, a journalist, is the one who made that act possible. Mm. Now, if you tell me that is a ringing defense of First Amendment principles, I'm going to say to you, you don't have good political judgment about where you're making your stand as the press, because that is not a winning set of facts.
And I hear you exactly. I hear the logic there. And yet Judith Miller standing on that principle tonight in a jail cell somewhere, her attorney today, Floyd Abrams, saying she's carrying on a long tradition of American journalistic integrity. Let's hear that.
Judy Miller today joins a long train of journalists throughout our history. Who have insisted on protecting the confidentiality of their sources. That goes back before the revolution itself, when Benjamin Franklin's brother wound up in jail because he, as the editor of a newspaper in Philadelphia, would not identify his confidential sources. It carries through the entirety of our history, in which journalists have been ordered by one body or another, state bodies, federal judges, state judges, to reveal their confidential sources, and they have refused to do so.
Judy Miller's attorney, Floyd Abrams, speaking today after Judy Miller was packed off to jail. We're talking tonight with Jay Rosen at New York University's Journalism Department, and Gordon with the Philadelphia Inquirer. We're joined right now by Leonard Bernstein. He's Deputy National Editor at The Washington Post. Leonard Bernstein, thanks for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
I wonder how you're interpreting all this. We're hearing a lot of different views tonight. One is, Bill Keller said it, and Gordon has said it to us tonight, big chilling effect here, not just along the eastern seaboard and big, powerful papers like your own, but right through the country, right into the middle of the country. On the other hand, a very complicated story here, and even journalists, as we're hearing tonight, not of one mind about where Judy Miller ought to be standing. How are you looking at what's going on from Washington?
Chilling effect, no doubt. I don't see any way that a reporter of Judy Miller's standing can go off to jail, and other reporters are not going to take note of that fact and think about it the next time they're called on to decide whether or not they're going to promise confidentiality to somebody over some issue. You're also correct that I think there's a lot of division and hand-wringing in the press. Because I think the facts of this case are very unclear at this moment. Was there a leak from the White House, or hypothetically, maybe this information started somewhere else? I mean, there's no way to know until Fitzgerald tells us the results of his investigation.
Bob Novak said senior administration officials. Does that mean the White House in Washington speak?
Yes, it could, but where did the information get started? How, when Joe Wilson's piece ran on the 8th of July, reporters started calling sources and they started having conversations. And who told who what? First, who first raised names? Who discussed this? None of this we know. That's what Fitzgerald, we believe, since he won't tell us, is after, trying to corroborate those conversations and who raised the information first.
Now, explain that for us. Your sense of what the special investigator, U.S. Attorney Patrick Fitzgerald, is up to here, that's murky. Walk us through that.
It's very murky. We don't know a lot about what he's after. What we know is he's got, for example, Matt Cooper's notes and emails that reveal Matt Cooper's sources. He says he still needs to talk to Matt Cooper and Judy Miller, of course. Why is that? I don't know. One theory, he needs to corroborate both ends of a conversation. Did Matt Cooper use Valerie Plame's name first, or did the person at the other end of the line use Valerie Plame's name first? Who knows? I don't know, and I think a lot of people down here don't know.
And where are journalists, where are you looking tonight? I mean, is Karl Rove still in play here? Is he a real, in journalistic terms, is he still a target? I don't mean a legal suspect, but a suspect?
What Mr. Robert Luskin has said, that's Karl Rove's attorney, is that Karl Rove is not the person who identified Valerie Plame to Matt Cooper, and he has said that Karl Rove is not the person who called Matt Cooper today and released him from his pledge of confidentiality. Beyond that, we don't know.
So where does that leave? You're in Washington. Where does that leave you all looking now?
We are going to continue to follow the case. We have to see what Fitzgerald does next. We have to see. I guess the chances of this are infinitesimal, but whether incarceration persuades Judy Miller to speak, there's a lot of we just have to continue to follow this like we have for the past 2 years.
And I don't suppose you've been there, but what do you know about the jailhouse in Alexandria, Virginia? How uncomfortable is Ms. Miller going to be?
I'm sorry, I don't know.
Mm. Leonard Bernstein at The Washington Post, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Sure.
And Gordon, you're listening on there. What do you hear in all this?
Well, I think there's still, as we've said here, there's just a great many questions. I think that, you know, as we've said, forcing reporters to reveal sources badly undermines news gathering, period. Second, because the Patrick Fitzgerald has not charged anybody with criminally leaking Valerie Plame's name to Robert Novak, mm-hmm. We have some questions asked there, and you begin to wonder, okay, when are there criminal charges going to be founded? What exactly are we following here? And third, because of reasons that really have yet to be explained, Robert Novak appears to face no jeopardy at all. So either he gave Fitzgerald the names of his sources, or he was given a pass, all of which brings up even more questions. So I think that I continue to worry about two things. One, where this investigation is going and who have been the victims of this investigation to this point. And two, the implications of this case are going to go far beyond the tangled little tale of the CIA operatives.
We're going to hear much more in just a minute. We've got to take a break. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the jailing of New York Times reporter Judith Miller today for protecting a confidential source in the outing of CIA operative Valerie Plame. Looking at the facts of the case and its implications for American journalism, you can join us tonight. Is Judith Miller acting above the law or defending an important principle here? Is Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald chasing the right lead? And 2 years after the leak, why hasn't the White House coughed up the leaker? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's hear a little bit more from Bill Keller, New York Times executive editor today, on why he thinks it's important for his reporter to protect sources.
To paraphrase Donald Rumsfeld, you go to court with the case you've got. It would be nice if there was absolute clarity about the nature of this case. On the contrary, there's immense mystery about this case. We have, court judgments with redacted pages, and because it's taking place in the venue of a grand jury, there's an awful lot we don't know, including exactly what crime the special prosecutor is pursuing. So, it's not the ideal case for for anybody in this. There are no winners in this. But the bottom line is that Judy Miller made a commitment to her source, and she's standing by it. That's in the highest tradition of this job we all do.
New York Times executive editor Bill Keller today after Judy Miller was sent to jail. We're joined tonight by Ann Gordon, managing editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer, and Jay Rosen, associate professor of journalism at New York University. A lot of callers want to join us as well. Deborah's calling from Dennis, Massachusetts. Hi, Deborah, you're on the air.
Hi. Actually, Ann Gordon did raise a point that I feel is extremely important. The crime that Fitzgerald is supposedly investigating is the release of Ms. Plame's name, which was done by Robert Novak, and there's something.
Well, someone leaked it to him,
right.
Revealing her as an undercover CIA operative. Yes,
but there's something almost Orwellian in jailing a journalist who was investigating that event, rather than the journalist to whom the information was leaked.
So why is Robert Novak still walking around,
right.
You're saying?
And the fact that he seems to have very friendly relations with the administration does seem just a little questionable here.
We've got it, Deborah. Thanks for your call. Ann Gordon, but what about it? Maybe they want to talk to Judith Miller to help them figure out who talked to Robert Novak.
Well, I don't know, and I don't think any one of us knows, but I think you have to ask a lot of questions with Fitzgerald saying the principle here is that no one is above the law. Well, in fact, where are we with this case? What is the crime that is being investigated here quite specifically, and where does Robert Novak fit into this investigation? And unfortunately, as Bill Keller was quoted as saying just a few minutes ago, there are really more questions in this case than there are answers, and it is not a perfect case. It is an unfortunate example, really, that we're talking about press freedoms versus the government with this case because, frankly, it's a mess.
Jay Rosen, pull back a little bit with us here. There's been a lot of talk about the level of secrecy in this administration, the success at kind of chilling inquiry. Of course, 9/11 played a big part in that as well, chilling press inquiry. When you look at it in those terms, do you see the atmosphere of press inquiry being cooled off here?
Well, if I back up 50 feet or so, I think the roots of today's events actually lie in that period in 2002 and 2003 when the administration decided to justify going to war on the basis of weapons of mass destruction, and I believe, along with many other people, forced the intelligence to fit that conclusion. And the press was, including Judith Miller, was intimately involved in that period. And I think today's events are actually an echo of that time. Secondly, there's no question, I've written about it extensively at my weblog, that the Bush administration has a different philosophy of the press, and it does not believe in the classic Fourth Estate model of the press. It does not think the Washington Press Corps, the White House Press Corps, is necessarily a legitimate interlocutor with the president. And really an historic kind of compromise or arrangement between the White House and the Washington Press, in which both benefited for a very long time, I believe has come apart. And it's impossible for me to look at these events without looking at the way that the Bush administration has rejected the Fourth Estate model, has in many ways tried to replace itself for the press, substitute itself for the press. And this, I think, is completely related to 9/11 and the feeling that the press has to be rolled back a little bit if we are to compete in a way with the closed societies, the terrorists, and our enemies.
The feeling in the White House, though I don't know how much more widely. But then you already expressed an ambivalence about what Judith Miller's done today. But when you step back 50 feet, as you say here, whether you agree with the detail of what she did or not, is she in effect standing up for that traditional Fourth Estate inquiring role of the press by simply refusing to play ball?
Absolutely, she is. She's standing on principle. She's a woman of principle. I admire her tremendously. My heart goes out to her and her husband. But if I look at her judgment, what I see is that because the press is weak in comparison to the government, it has to stand on principle when it has a strong case. And to claim rights that are kind of above and beyond what the average person is able to do is for the American press not a winning strategy in the long run. And that's one of the things that concerns me about this case.
But on the other hand, and let me put this to you, if the press has been kind of in retreat, as Jay Rosen describes it, and I think there's pretty general agreement on that, you've got to stand up somewhere.
Well, that's exactly the case, and I think you do have to stand up, and I think you do have to represent the traditional values that have served this country and democracy very well. History is on the side of reporters working diligently to reveal information specifically about the government that has in the end been for the betterment of society. The notion that there are tens of thousands of journalists out there breaking the law and running amok is nonsense. It's nonsense. So the reality of it is that history would point to the fact that standing on principle and honoring your commitments, doing what you said you were going to do, is a valuable tool in the service of democracy.
I know there's some ambiguity here, but maybe I'm old-fashioned, but when a reporter's sitting in jail for reporting, something in my head says wrong. Bill's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I'm so pleased that you're dealing with this issue. I am frankly saddened and somewhat horrified at the lack of interest in pursuing these kinds of issues. The press has a right to sources that are confidential so that it can actually uncover wrongdoing. We've seen over many decades in this country and other countries what happens when the press is muzzled. I have a son-in-law from Mexico where there's very little reported about drug traffic there because so many of the reporters have been murdered. So to not protect the press seems to me to be a horrifying situation, and I'm just mystified at why Novak is being left out of the picture. It's so strange to me, and it smacks so much of political favoritism and choosing which sides. It's just like with condemning NPR as biased and so forth. This is the whole tenor of this administration seems to be to divide, to separate, to condemn. I'm just so saddened and tired of this approach that's been taken, and I would just like to hear your speaker, your guests' comments on these issues.
Bill, thanks for your call. Jay Rosen, our time's growing short here, but it is interesting that we don't know exactly what's going on, but Robert Novak has been quite supportive to this administration, and as we've noted all night, he's not the one in jail.
I think whenever the facts come out, he's going to have a lot of explaining to do, but even more so, his bosses at CNN and the Chicago Sun-Times are going to have to ask themselves whether they want this person around. But I also think that it's part of the Bush administration's feeling that the press really should be rolled back. It really needs to be rolled back, just like liberals need to be rolled back and other gains that opponents of the government, of the Republicans, have made should be rolled back. And ultimately, the press needs to resist that, but it can only resist that successfully with public support, with American public seeing that it has a stake in what journalists do. And arguments that divide the press from the public are to be looked at more critically, in my view.
We hear that. And Gordon, finally to you, we've just got half a minute here. Do you see the press having been effectively rolled back, as Jay puts it? Do you see it staying rolled back?
Absolutely.
You do?
I absolutely don't believe that they've been rolled back, and I don't believe they're going to stay rolled back. I believe the press still remains a powerful and viable institution in this country, and that democracy needs the press, and they need these kinds of arguments, they need these kinds of discussions, so that people can value what an open, transparent society gives you, and that's the ability to have comment, to wonder, to affect your government. But I also don't want to let the press completely off the hook. There have been some self-inflicted wounds. The New York Times has gotten stories wrong. The Philadelphia Inquirer has gotten stories wrong. That has to be out there, too, and has to be openly discussed. But the press is willing to discuss its mistakes. Government is often not willing to do that.
And tonight, a reporter sits in jail, Judith Miller of the New York Times. Ann Gordon at the Philadelphia Inquirer, managing editor there. We're very grateful to you for being with us tonight. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And Jay Rosen, author of What Are Journalists For?, associate professor of journalism at New York University. Jay, always great talking with you. Thank you for joining us tonight.
My pleasure, Tom.
Listeners, in a moment, a look at the economics behind today's Olympic victory for London. This is On Point. Today in Singapore, International Olympics Committee President Jacques Roga announced that London will host the 2012 Summer Olympics.
The International Olympic Committee has the honor of announcing that the Games of the 30th Olympiad in 2012 are awarded to the city of London.
The announcement was greeted with cheers in London's Trafalgar Square. It was met with sad silence in Paris, New York, Moscow, and Madrid, all of which saw their Olympic dreams die. But perhaps it is those four cities that are the real winners today. Past Olympiads have not always produced the economic windfalls that city officials hope for. Montreal, for example, is still paying off debts from the 1976 Games. Joining me now with a look at the economics of hosting the Olympics is Victor Matheson, economics professor at the College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts. He's studied the economic impact the Olympics can have on host cities. And Victor Matheson, I guess you're finding it's not always great.
Yes, that's correct. There's certainly some unhappy people on bid committees in Paris and New York, but really the citizens of the four cities who didn't win should be breathing a sigh of relief tonight.
What's the record here? What does it look like? A lot of cities have worked awfully hard to get these games, summer games in particular, and what's the aftermath?
Well, in some cities have done very, very well. One example is Los Angeles in 1984. Los Angeles came out with a large profit after the games, but that's in large part because in 1984, no one else around the country or around the world wanted to host the games. They followed up a disastrous games in 1972 because of the Israeli terrorist incident.
In Munich.
They followed up a highly unprofitable games in Montreal, and then the economic disaster in Moscow when the United States and many of the other Western countries decided not to go.
Why did that make L.A. successful? Simply the other people not wanting to host the games. Why did that, or what was it that made the games profitable there?
Well, what happened is L.A. was the only city bidding. So L.A. could say, listen, we're not going to build a bunch of fancy, new, expensive facilities for the Olympics. We're going to use the same facilities that we used 50 years ago when we last held.
That's right. I remember that now. That's right.
So that when you don't have to build billions of dollars of new specialized infrastructure, you can really have quite a successful games. Of course, the other thing going on in 1984, which is not going on in 2004 or 2008, is 1984, of course, was before the 9/11 incidents.
Mm-hmm.
And security measures have gotten much, much more expensive nowadays.
How did Greece and Athens finally come out with their high-wire act around the Olympics? It was beautiful when it came off. Did it leave them in good position or not?
Certainly not. What Greece is left with is over $1.5 billion that they spent on security. That's money that they don't get back. They're left with a bunch of beautiful facilities, but facilities that are very specialized and you don't get to use much. For example, they've got a beautiful swimming facility that seats 10,000 spectators, but I mean, really, how often do you need a swimming pool that 10,000 people can come watch an event? Once every 4 years, actually, as it turns out.
And yet, cities just bend over backwards, jump through hoops, do everything they can to get these things. The Champs-Élysées was turned into a track to try and attract the Olympics there. Tony Blair went all out, went to Singapore. London saying, look, our East End is going to be transformed by this. What is it that keeps cities coming? What is it? The British are not fools. What is it that made them work so hard to get these games?
Well, certainly there is a sense of civic pride going on. The Beijing Olympics, China is really using the 2008 Olympics as a real measure to suggest that we have arrived on the international stage. South Africa is going to use the 2010 World Cup in exactly the same sort of way. But it's an expensive way to say that, yes, we've arrived.
Maybe it's a way to transfer wealth within a country. Will the rest of the UK end up subsidizing a refurbishing of the East End in London?
That's certainly something to be considered. Who really pays for these games? If it's the American people who ended up paying for a large portion of the security for the Salt Lake City Games in 2002. So Salt Lake City event organizers might say, yes, we actually turned a profit, but it's pretty easy to turn a profit when you don't have to pay for all the costs.
And we just got half a minute here, but your message to New Yorkers tonight as they see their fallen bid, how should they feel?
They should go out and celebrate every bit as much as the Londoners, perhaps one drink more.
Well, it's not a romantic vision, but the bottom line might be right. Victor Matheson, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Victor Matheson, professor of economics at the College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts. He spoke with me from San Francisco. I'm Tom Ashbrook. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amada, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Susanna Dillaplane, Persephone Miel, Marika Bukas, Tim Skog, and Angel Coselli. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.